Good morning, Council. How are you today?
Good morning. Doing well. How are you?
Good. We are set for arguments today. This is docket number 79604. Wait a second. This is... Yeah, 79604. Filippo versus Foremost Insurance. And as you can see, we've got Justice Silver in the Las Vegas courtroom, and I am here with Justice Stiglitz in the Carson City courtroom. We're all nice and socially distanced, so I think we're ready to go. Counsel, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
And would you like to save any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jordan Schnitzer, and I represent Filippo Sciarrata. In this case, Farmers is attempting to enforce an invalid exclusion despite the fact that its own internal records show the exclusion was never given to the insured until the crash at issue. In this case, given that the district court's decision was based on pure legal issues, I think this court's standard of review is a de novo basis based upon Wood v. Safeway. My client in this case was riding as a passenger on his own motorcycle. It's undisputed that the driver of that motorcycle was negligent, causing a crash, and that Mr. Sciarrata's liability policy issued by Foremost on that motorcycle policy covered the crash and paid its full policy limits. Now, Mr. Sciarrata also had an umbrella policy, and the declarations page of that umbrella policy lists the Foremost motorcycle liability policy as a policy to which the umbrella policy provided excess coverage. That's on appellant's appendix page 251. In this case, the parties have stipulated that Mr. Sciarrata's damages exceed the amount of the umbrella policy. So the only issue for the court is whether or not an alleged exclusion that Farmers is attempting to enforce applies. In this case, Farmers never claimed that it complied with NRS 687B.147. And additionally, the documents provided by Farmers show that the exclusions at issue were not mailed to the insured. And that's on appellant's appendix, page 249.
Mr. Schnitzer, let me ask you a question about that.
Does
the cover page that in question that you're talking about actually demonstrate the insureds never received a copy of the policy, or just that they didn't receive a copy with those particular declarations on March 19, 2015?
If you look at page 249, what's checked off, it says attached is a true copy of the original declarations page. The attached policy back and endorsements did not mail with this declarations page, but are included as requested. If you look two spots above that, there's a line that says attached is a true copy of the original information sent to the insured. That's not checked off. So had the full policy been provided to the insured, they would have checked off the top portion of the top box on that page. So given the information that we've got, Farmer's own information, the declaration, the exclusion was never provided to the insured.
Now, do we know if his wife received it, or his ex-wife now, but the person who made the insurance contract?
According to Farmer's own documents, no. Because if you look, this is addressed to Cynthia Sciarrata. So according to their own documents, this information was never provided to the insured. Cynthia is the named insured. Filippo was the husband at the time and living at the house. So their own documents say, no, this was never provided. And at the very least, to the extent that the court is not convinced that so shows it with such certainty, it creates an issue of fact that at least needs to be explored. And we asked for more discovery to explore that issue. But I think based upon this alone, and given the fact that it was Farmer's motion for summary judgment, it's their duty to show that it was provided. And there's no evidence before the court that it was ever provided. And again, Farmer's own document shows it was not provided. And one of the big issues is that the district court in this case never even addressed this argument. If you look at the court's order, it was based purely on whether or not 687B.147 applied. They never addressed my argument that the exclusion was never given. So what's interesting is that Farmers actually had the same issue arise in Utah in the 1980s. And in Farmers Exchange versus Call, the Supreme Court of Utah stated that we therefore hold that where the insurer fails to disclose material exclusions in an automobile policy and the purchaser is not informed of them in writing, those exclusions are invalid. So this is not something that's new to Farmers. It's not the first time they've done it.
But that's an automobile policy, correct? And you're talking about an umbrella policy. So tell me how that factors into this.
Are you talking about in the Call case?
No, I'm just talking about the exclusion, the 687B147.
Right. I'm not sure I understand what's in your question.
Well, the applies to the notice provision, not complying with 687-147B, not receiving the notice of the exclusion, does that apply to the umbrella policy as opposed to a motor vehicle policy?
I think it does, and I think we're talking about two separate things.
Okay.
There's number one is, did you actually provide a copy of the policy with the exclusion to the insured?
Okay.
That's the very first thing. I don't care what the exclusion is, public policy, the Call case, the Wisconsin case we cited. If you don't actually give them the exclusion in writing, you can't enforce that because the insured's not aware of what that exclusion is. But if you look at the Wisconsin Supreme Court case, it says if an insured is not given a copy of the policy, he or she cannot take whatever action is appropriate to protect his or her interests, nor can she ensure that the coverage which he or she thinks has been contracted for is actually provided. We therefore hold that an insurer may not deny coverage based on limitations or exclusion, even if clearly stated, where the insured was not otherwise informed of such provisions. So that's just a general policy that if you're not given a copy of your policy, you can't enforce an exclusion. Then I think what your question was does 687B.147 apply to umbrella policies versus
right.
primary motor vehicle problems? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a separate. Right, so that's a totally separate issue and a second basis, I think, for finding in my client's favor. So it's our position that the district court erred in ignoring the binding precedent of Del Mew and relying upon non-binding precedent of the federal district court case.
Mr. Schnitzer, you're not disputing, though, that, I mean, Cynthia got the policy. You're just saying he didn't.
No, there is no evidence that Cynthia was provided anything other than the declarations page.
But who has the burden of proving that? Like, where is the affirmative evidence other than this page that she did not receive any of these policies? This is 2015 is a renewal. What happened in 2014 when she made the contract?
That's a great question. And this is Farmers' cause of action, Farmers' motion for summary judgment. The moving party always has the burden. I'm sorry.
Mr. Schnitzer, I'm looking at an affidavit from Kimberly Pickard that says that it was mailed to Cynthia. I'm looking at the affidavit that was attached. So it appears that it was sent to the insured.
It's.
Am I wrong? I mean, I'm looking at an affidavit.
That is the declarations page. And if you look at Appellant's Appendix 249, there's a box to check there that says attaches a true copy of the original information sent to the insured. That's not checked. What's checked is a true copy of the original declarations page. The policy back endorsements did not mail. So you can't have an affidavit saying one thing was done that clearly contradicts their own internal documents. And at the very least, it creates a question of fact that a jury needs to resolve. That's not something that can be, if you believe that her affidavit is sufficient. But, going back to the issue of 687B.147, when you look at the plain meaning of the statute, a policy of motor vehicle insurance covering a private passenger car, that includes umbrella policies. This court in a state of Del Mew held that a policy of insurance covering the use of a passenger car includes umbrella policies. The legislature then amended 687B.145 to have a specific exclusion with regard to umbrella policies. They didn't redefine covering the use of a passenger car. The legislature actually accepted the holding in Del Mew. And one of the reasons we know that is because if you look at subsection 5 of section 145, they use the phrase, or other policy that does not provide primary motor vehicle insurance. And that's a direct quote from this court's holding in Del Mew. And if the legislature knew about the Del Mew holding and changed 145, Del Mew actually states that, well, then they would have known about 147. If it was their intent to change 147, they would have done so. The Repke decision essentially, I think, totally gets it wrong. They said that this court attempted to define a policy of insurance covering a passenger car. This court didn't do it. It actually did define it. And none of the subsequent changes to 145 changed the application of 147. And unless the court has other questions for me, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am ready, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Gina Sluga, and I'm here today to argue on behalf of Farmers Insurance Exchange. And, Your Honors, you're being asked to consider today, as a matter of first impression, whether a household exclusion in a personal umbrella policy violates NRS 687B147 or otherwise violates Nevada public policy. But, Your Honors, bad facts make bad law, and these are very bad facts for you to consider that as a matter of first impression. Why? Number one, even if the statute applies to this policy, which by its face it doesn't, this claim is not one protected by the statute. Claimant is not one of the claimants that Nevada public policy would protect in the statute. And you're being presented this question with the backdrop of the myth that Your Honor, Justice Stiglitz has already asked questions about. And I'm going to dispel the myth first. The myth is that somehow Ms. Strada never received a copy of her policy, and there's nothing in the record to show that. This issue came up in response to the MSJ that was filed a full year into this litigation. And in response, you did not receive an affidavit from Ms. Sherrod, the policyholder, to even suggest that she didn't have it, didn't know about it, or even that she'd looked for it, couldn't find it. So maybe there was a fact question on the issue. She didn't say that. There's nothing from her in the record. There's nothing even from Mr. Sherrod, appellant, who didn't purchase the policy, but he doesn't say that in an affidavit that it's even possible that he didn't receive it. So you don't have anything from the policyholder or the policyholder's husband. What you have is a statement from the policyholder's husband's lawyer, who reiterates some hearsay in the record, and he certainly reiterates it for the truth of the matter asserted therein. He reads from the cover sheet that accompanied the copy of the policy produced in litigation. He somehow proved that his clients didn't have the policy. And you're right, Your Honor. This is a renewal form that's clear on appellant's own record. And renewal policies often don't include every single form with the original, and that's okay. So you have nothing in the record to show that the appellant or his wife didn't have a copy of his original policy, hadn't gotten copies from their agent, didn't have access to the policies through the electronic means that most people today use to have their proof of insurance rather than cluttering their glove box every 6 months with another piece of paper. Trial court correctly concluded that counsel's hearsay-based argument could not defeat summary judgment, which was supported by an affidavit. So that's the myth. Nothing in the record in admissible form to create a question of fact. And he didn't need time for discovery on this because appellant had it within his own means at the very beginning of this case to provide his own affidavit with his own telling to actually create a fact question. But counsel's regurgitation of hearsay doesn't get the job done under Rule 56. So that's the myth. What are the bad facts here? The bad fact is that this court is being asked to consider the statute in the context of a claim that has nothing to do with the statute. And to be clear, this policy does contain a household exclusion. Why? What is a household exclusion? Why do policies have them? A household exclusion precludes coverage for a claim brought by one member of a household by another member of the household. And one Nevada jurist explained in a dissenting opinion that these exclusions exist to protect insurance companies from the natural partiality of the insured to assist the injured person when he or she is a member of the family circle. Even without actual dishonesty appearing, the natural bias and sympathies of the insured might easily render every such claim a dangerous one. It was explained in Mallon v. Farmers Insurance Exchange in 1992. And so these are reasonable. They're generally enforceable unless they contravene the statute or contravene public policy. So let's look at the statute. NRS 687B147, that's a mouthful. So I'm going to just call that the household exclusion statute, if that's okay, Your Honors. It applies where an insurer seeks to limit coverage for the liability of a named insured for damages to a member of the household. So if we want to put that insured, where a named insured is a defendant and the plaintiff suing is a member of the household, the statute is going to apply there. But Mr. Sharada wasn't a defendant. He wasn't sued by anyone. He was a plaintiff. He brought the claim. And what's more, the person he sued, Jonas Stoss, was not a member of his household. This claim has nothing whatsoever to do with the statute that applies to claims regarding the liability of a named insured. Now, what if it had? The way we would have had that is if Ms. Sharada, his wife at the time, had been the driver, if she was driving the motorcycle and caused the accident, that's where the statute applies. What's the difference? Let's think about it for a minute. That's where Nevada wants to step in, because if appellant and his former wife were insured under the same policy of insurance, like most households manage their insurance needs, he would have been left with no source of recovery if his wife caused the accident and their only policy for the two of them has a household exclusion. He's left with nothing, not even the state minimum coverage that is guaranteed under Nevada's financial responsibility statutes. So there's a statute that says in that context, these exclusions are suspect, and you've got to give them the $15,000 state minimum coverage guaranteed under the statute. But here, Mr. Sharada didn't sue a member of his household, so he had lots of sources of recovery. He collected $25,000 from the tortfeasor's own policy. He collected $500,000 from the motorcycle policy. Now, did those policies have household exclusions? Maybe. But it doesn't matter, because he didn't sue a member of his household. So he had coverage, and he collected $525,000 in liability coverage. And then, as it turns out, the motorcycle was underinsured for the injuries he sustained. So he made a UIM claim to the motorcycle policy. And despite the fact the UIM policy had a household exclusion, he got paid another $15,000, because the household exclusion is valid to preclude coverage above $15,000 state minimum. So he got paid that. And then he brought a claim, another stacked UIM claim, under an unrelated auto policy. And he again got paid. That's four sources of recovery, all of which at least gave him state minimum coverage, so it gave him many times more. But if he had been dissatisfied with those four sources of recovery, there are two ways that this insured could have purchased more insurance to protect himself from this situation, even if all the policies had household exclusions. Let us not forget that the underinsured vehicle here was appellant's own vehicle. And if he'd wanted more than $500,000 in coverage on that vehicle, he could have purchased it. The other way he could have protected against this was to simply ask his wife, when purchasing their personal umbrella liability policy, to also purchase UIM coverage with it. That coverage was not purchased, and accordingly, there is nothing in the statute or the relevant decision authority that can allow this court to change the personal umbrella policy into yet another UIM policy. This court has stated that there is a well-recognized difference between liability insurance and underinsured motorist coverage. They are different, and we can't convert this umbrella policy into even more UIM, especially when it was offered and rejected. So appellant stands before you with a claim that is unrelated to the statute and a policy that is unrelated to the statute, asking for a right that is not protected by the statute or Nevada public policy. He wants $1 million more after more than $550,000 already having been collected. And He stands before you making that request without citing to a single Nevada case ever in which a claimant has recovered more than $15,000 in coverage when raising concerns about a household exclusion. Ever. It's never happened. Baker v. Criterion Insurance is directly on point. Ruth Baker was injured while riding as a passenger in her own vehicle. The driver did not have his own insurance, so she made a claim to her insurance company. The driver was a permissive user of her vehicle, so she collected her limits of $15,000, just like Mr. Sherrata collected the $500,000 limits of the motorcycle policy. So then she submitted a UIM claim to Criterion, and Criterion denied the claim. This court upheld the denial. Why? Because she'd already been paid $15,000 under her own liability policy. This court stated Baker should not be permitted to circumvent the household exclusion in her policy by making a claim for UIM damages. So because she'd collected $15,000, she didn't get anything more because that's all the household exclusion statute guarantees her, or public policy about household exclusions gives to her. So to be clear, if the statute applied to this policy and if it applied to this claim, it would guarantee him $15,000 in coverage. He's already collected more. Time and again, this court has said $15,000 is what you get. The court said it even in Gulf v. Farmrich in 2014, long after the statute was adopted. The court had to consider the impact of a household exclusion in a Mississippi policy. And the court posed the question as this: are we going to enforce Mississippi law in which the household exclusion is okay, no coverage, or are we going to apply Nevada law and give $15,000 in state minimum coverage? Were those the limits of the policy? No. The limits were $100,000. But that wasn't the question this court asked. You asked, if Nevada law applies, do they get $15,000? They didn't even get that. Mississippi law applied.
Ms. Sluga?
Same result. Neal. Same result in Granillo.
Excuse me, ma'am?
He stands before you without a single case.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm going to ask a couple questions. Just kind of circle back to where we started with Mr. Schnitzer. Was the household exclusion, in fact, disclosed to the insured at some point?
We have nothing in the record to suggest that it was not. That issue was raised in an objection to an MSJ and was raised with inadmissible evidence.
And who bears the burden of proof on that point?
Because he wanted to use it to create a fact question, they needed to create a fact question with admissible evidence, which they didn't do. And I don't think that it's something that Farmers has to prove. Here we prove that there's a contract and there's a claim and it doesn't apply. If they want relief from the contract provisions, they needed to demonstrate why they got the relief, and they couldn't demonstrate that with even an affidavit from appellant himself.
Okay, why was, or do you think Mr. Sherrata's counsel's affidavit asking for additional discovery was insufficient under Choi? And so do you think the court was right or did not err in denying the motion to continue? And tell me why.
Because he did not need time to conduct discovery to get his own client's affidavit. The MSJ was filed a full year after his complaint, and you can see the dates in his own papers. And in that year, certainly he could have spoken to his own client or the ex-wife or the agent, their agent, to get any of that evidence. He didn't need discovery to get his own client's affidavit. There was nothing there. Also, again, the statute and all of these notice requirements doesn't apply to this policy on its face. The household exclusion statute applies to policies of motor vehicle insurance. Now, appellant takes liberties in the papers by telling you those are the exact same words of the Delmu court and of the statute it interpreted, and that is a mistake. They are not the same words. The statute at issue in Delmu applied to a policy of insurance covering the use of a private passenger car. Policy of insurance is not a term of art. It's not used anywhere else in the NRSs, and it's vague. It's a descriptive term. And this court said, well, maybe that descriptive term includes umbrella coverage. The legislature corrected the ambiguity and said no, but they didn't need to do it in the household exclusion statute because there was never ambiguity. This statute applies to motor vehicle insurance and only motor vehicle insurance. In the Delmu case, Allstate wanted the court to say that the UMUIM statute was talking about the kind of insurance at issue in Nevada's financial responsibility statute. No one has to urge that here because the statute itself says it. Motor vehicle insurance. Those are the words in the statute. Those words weren't in the UIM statute. And those are the very words that is the title of Nevada's financial responsibility code. When the court gave us a short title for that section, for section 485, the court's calling the Motor Vehicle Insurance and Financial Responsibility Act. Those are the words at issue in the household exclusion. Those were never the words at issue in Delmu. The court had no ambiguity to correct in this statute, which on its face applies only to motor vehicle insurance, which by statute does not include umbrella coverage. We know that because of NRS 485-1091. It's just not there. So you have a statute that doesn't apply to a policy, a claim that's not within the statute, and a claimant who wants more money than Nevada law has ever protected. There has never been a case where someone got more than $15,000 in coverage over concerns regarding a household exclusion. It doesn't apply here. He cannot collect more than the $550,000 in coverage that he has already been paid.
Thank you, Ms. Sluga. Schnitzer, you've got, you've got 4 minutes and 59 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you. I do want to address several issues. First, I want to go back to the affidavit that was raised by Ms. Pickard. If you read the affidavit, it simply states that this is the policy between the two. Nothing in that affidavit says that the complete policy was ever provided to Ms. Sherrod. It just says this was a copy of our policy. So read it carefully. Please, when you get a chance, go back and look, and you'll see.
Let me ask you this. Justice Stiglitz tried to get an answer from you earlier. Whose burden is it to come forward with that evidence? You were faced with a motion for summary judgment, and you were presented an affidavit. And I can't imagine it'd be too difficult to get an affidavit from your client indicating if she had received the policy.
So if you're talking about Cynthia Sherrata, at the time they were divorced and not on speaking terms. So that was not something that was easy, but I did ask the court for more time to take her deposition, get her under subpoena. And so I did ask for that, and I think that was a reasonable request that should have been given to flesh this out further. But sir,
your own client didn't do an affidavit saying, I never got it.
Sir, in my opinion, I thought it had to come from Cynthia because he's not the named insured. So that's why I asked for more time to depose Cynthia Sherrata. What's interesting about Ms. Luga's argument that she ended with was that her argument contradicts the Repke decision, which the district court relied upon. The Repke court agrees with my argument that the statute as written includes umbrellas, but implied some legislative intent based upon the change in NRS 687.145. What Ms. Sluga just argued was that, no, the statute, in fact, is clear on its face and clear in farmers' favor. That's something that no court has ever decided. And I think what's important is that this court in Delmu differentiated between all policies covering motor vehicles and what the court called primary policies covering motor vehicles. And in fact, the legislature used that language in 687.145 subsection B, where it says that, or other policies that does not provide primary motor vehicle insurance policies. So even the legislature has acknowledged that primary applies to the initial policy, but umbrella excess can still be motor vehicle policies that provide coverage. So I don't think Ms. Sluga's argument that she made for the first time today is supported by any case law or by the statutes that we've got. And I also wanted to go back one more time to the issue of whether or not the policy was ever given. Importantly, the district court made no factual findings about whether the policy was ever given to the insured. And so that was one of the points I raised at the beginning, was the district court totally ignored that. factual issues are for the district court to determine. And we'd be in a different situation if the district court made a factual finding that my client or the insured received the policy. That was something that was never found by the district court. The district court didn't find anything one way or another. So again, at the very least, I think I've raised a factual issue that should have precluded summary judgment, or perhaps the court should send it back to the district court to make those factual findings, because legal issues should be raised de novo, but I think it's the district court's position to make initial factual findings. And so I think that's an issue with regard to the district court's order. And finally, I want to address this issue of my client seeking money that he's not entitled to and counsel mentioning these large amounts of money. What you never heard from counsel was that my client wasn't injured to the extent that his damages exceed or he's entitled to that amount of money. In fact, Farmers has stipulated that my client's damages exceed the $1 million umbrella policy in addition to all other policies. So this isn't an issue of my client seeking double recovery or my client seeking damages he's not entitled to. Farmers acknowledges he was injured to the extent that he would be entitled to that amount of money if the policy applies. So when you look at the facts, he purchased an umbrella policy. This is not about UIM. He purchased this umbrella policy to cover excess liability on the Foremost policy. The Foremost policy liability applied. The umbrella policy covers excess liability above that. And on that basis, he has bought and paid for the insurance. And we'd ask that the court reverse the district court's decision. Thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you for the arguments today. We appreciate you being here. Very helpful. This matter will stand submitted. We'll stand in recess.